From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings.
Well, I don't think many 18th century novels read now as quaint or dated. Some of them do. Sometimes I think current readers, are puzzled by some aspects of language. The language has changed to some extent. Some 18th century novels are more formal in the way they use language than 20th century examples. But there's been a real continuity in the novel from its beginning to the present time.
The rise of the English novel. That's the topic this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars who have completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Paul Hunter of the University of Rochester and Patricia Meyer Spax of Yale University. According to Paul Hunter and Patricia Meyer Spax, English fiction rose to prominence in the 18th century at about the same time that autobiography became important in England's cultural life, reflecting an interest on the part of the common reader in everyday life and in the concept of self. Early English novels were enormously popular, but they were also the object of sometimes harsh criticism. For example, the English author and lexicographer Samuel Johnson declared that readers of novels were the young, the ignorant, and the idle. Pat Spax from Yale University and Paul Hunter from the University of Rochester. We are going to discuss the English novel, the early English novel. We're going to talk about autobiography and concepts of self. Pat, let me begin with you. How do you find connections among and between these elements?
Well, it's certainly a historical fact that autobiography became an important form in English literature at about the time that the novel became an important form. I would connect both of them with the notion of self and with the new importance that was being given to the self. The autobiography before the 18th century in England had been primarily the spiritual autobiography, the account of religious conversion focused on the spiritual life. Certain early novels adopted that concept. Paul has written brilliantly about one of them. And as autobiography became secularized as a form, so did novels become secularized as a form, giving a different kind of account of the development of the self.
Mm-hmm. Paul, are we talking here about the rise of what we now call psychology? How would a word like that have entered into the mix?
Probably with great resistance at the beginning. I think what we're talking about is a concern with the self that takes two distinctly different kinds of forms. One that's philosophical, essentially, the kind of concern with the self that one finds in Locke and his followers and his contemporaries, but also on a much more popular level, growing out of the kind of spiritual autobiographies that Pat mentioned, a concern that is pretty widespread in the culture that affects a lot of common people. The fact that people were concerned with what was going on in their own lives and were writing it down and analyzing it and reviewing it and going over it leads to a certain kind of concern, broad-spread concern in the culture that really, in a direct way, I suppose, has nothing to do with the novel, but certainly in the sense of the novel being related to the things that people were thinking about in their daily lives has a very close connection.
Pat Spax.
One of the great philosophic issues of the 18th century was the notion of self and whether such a thing as the self really existed. The philosopher David Hume, for example, called into question the very notion of a continuous self, suggesting that we believe in the continuity of ourselves simply because of our memories, but there is no way of proving that what we remember has any relation to objective facts, since, as everyone knows, it's possible to misremember, to remember things that never happened, as well as not to remember things that did happen. So the climate of opinion in which this preoccupation with novel and autobiography developed was was one in which the notion of self had a new kind of urgency just because it was no longer so readily assumed.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, on a more popular level, as far as readers are concerned, there's a very special reason that the English novel is more our focus. That reason has to do with the Protestantism of England.
How is that?
Well, there's a to go back to autobiography a little bit, the kind of diary keeping model, the kind of spiritual autobiography that grows out of diary keeping, and the widespread practice of diary keeping, has its, if not its origins, at least a very strong amount of its impetus in the Protestant desire to analyze the place of the individual in the divine scheme. And to be sure what that place consisted of, the practice of diary keeping was as widespread as it was, no doubt, because individuals were very concerned about, in the first place, their state of the soul, how they saw themselves in relation to external events, and the kind of analysis that they provided for themselves within the within their diaries meant that there was a great deal of concern with subjectivity, a great deal of concern with the place of the individual. Mm-hmm. I think that is, in the beginning, distinctively English. It's not that no one else in the history of the world has been concerned with that, but there is a terrific amount of concentration on those issues in the culture itself. I think, I might just add one thing about it. I think the fact that so many people, we tend to think of them as Puritans, and it's true that the strongest impetus came from the dissenting sects, but the fact that so many people, Anglicans and dissenters, kept diaries in the 17th century and on into the 18th, and it became a widespread cultural practice, meant, among other things, that there were a lot of people out there when the novel began to be written who had already constructed first-person narratives of one kind or another. There were authors who were reading books that were constructed along the same lines, or at least with some of the same concerns that they had already expressed about themselves.
Mm-hmm. The trouble with this kind of discussion of the novel as a cultural phenomenon or as a phenomenon related to philosophic developments is that it loses the sense of the enormous immediate narrative excitement of the early English novels. These were wonderful novels. They were novels that everybody read. They were novels that they are novels that excite people who read them now. And the kind of urgency of their writing, which is related to these philosophic and spiritual issues, is reflected in the kind of immediate vitality of the life on the page. And I think it's very important to recall that there was a genuine confusion between fiction and fact in the early 18th century novels, that books like Robinson Crusoe were in fact presented as fact, as people's real life stories, and that people reading them did not necessarily know that they were reading fiction.
You're telling me that the docudrama is nothing new. the confusion that comes, we do a TV miniseries on the Kennedys or somebody.
Dr. Johnson's worry about the novel, which was articulated by many people beyond Dr. Johnson, is that the novel created mixed characters. It created characters who were not purely good or purely evil, and that this might encourage readers to believe that it was all right to be bad some of the time if you were good the rest of the time. Johnson felt that it was important to have unmixed characters. Beyond that, the more interesting objection to the novel in relation to values is that the novel encouraged a confusion between fantasy and fact, and it encouraged people to live a life of fantasy and to lose track of the realities of their situation. And again, it was mainly women who were worried about that women would develop fantasies about Prince Charming, about some wonderful man who would come along, and they wouldn't marry the man next door and settle down to raising children.
So what we're talking about is damning and praising the human imagination at the same time.
That's right. There's a parallel worry to the one that Pat just talked about for men that comes up very frequently among the moralists, too. And that is that their expectations will be raised. That is, they can be economic and social expectations, that people will think that real life will afford them opportunities that it won't really afford them. You get a tremendous split among contemporary particularly churchmen and people who saw themselves as guardians of the public morality, in their whole attitude toward the reading experience. On the one hand, a terrific push for universal literacy, a belief that everyone, no matter what kind of social circumstances, really should be allowed to read and should be almost forced to read, and that's terribly important to salvation, among other things, and to survival in a more practical kind of way. But then at the same time, a great concern that people once taught to read will read the wrong things. They'll read novels, they'll read plays, they'll read frivolous stuff which will turn their heads and ruin them. Pat Spax?
There was an enormous amount of worry about the effects of imagination, but I would like to make a very serious claim that novels carried and enforced the most important values of the culture in the 18th century, and that as the century went on and as assumptions of value started to change, those changing assumptions reflect themselves very quickly in the novel, or maybe are even articulated first in the novel. There's really no way of knowing. One of the things that interests me is a shift that takes place from the early novel to the early 19th century novel. I'm speaking of the novels of Fielding, say, in the middle of the 18th century, to the novels of Jane Austen at the beginning of the 19th century, between books in which the assumption is that what makes things happen is power, so the plots come out of intersections of power, and the assumption, to put it very simply, that what makes things happen is feeling, and that people's feelings cause things to happen. That is a shift. I mean, that is a change of values of the most enormous importance, I think.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about the origins and development of English fiction. My guests are two scholars who have completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Paul Hunter of the University of Rochester and Patricia Meyer Spax of Yale University. During her fellowship year at the center, Patricia Meyer Spax wrote a book entitled Gossip, published by Alfred Knopf in 1985. During his year at the center, Paul Hunter worked on a forthcoming book entitled The Origins of the English Novel. Let's follow that up. Paul Hunter and Pat Spax, our topic is the early English novel. Maybe you can talk about sentimentality, feelings, the things that Pat has just described and touched on. And at the same time, let me invite your comments about some technical kinds of things, plot and structure. Why are those important for us to consider as we look at the beginnings of the novel? Paul?
Well, they're important technical elements from the beginning, of course. They weren't as often talked about by the early novelists as they were later on, as there's much more self-consciousness among later novelists. The early novelists didn't really realize, I suppose from our perspective, that they were writing novels. They were writing books of a certain kind that they saw as very important and related to the tradition, sometimes in terms of an extension of epic or an extension of history, personal history, so that they didn't tend to use the kinds of technical terms that we use. There isn't a great deal of critical literature about plot or character, setting, although there is a good deal of self-consciousness that one can extract from the novels themselves.
What would all the graduate students in the 20th century do without words like that?
Well, we couldn't operate without words like that, clearly, and clearly, just because there wasn't a great deal of technical discussion didn't mean that there wasn't a great deal of concern. I think one of the things, I want to come back to Pat's point in a minute about the change in the impetus for narrative and the kind of force that has on the way novels are structured. But I want to make one other point first about the early novel, and that is that the kind of readership that you've mentioned, the broad readership that we have for novels that we know was there, and the kind of range of characters that novelists created, both bear testimony to a tremendously widespread cultural concern for what other people were like. And I think that has a great deal to do with the effect that the novel had, the impact that it had on early readers, because there was this widespread cultural curiosity among people in all at all levels of society about what other people were. Mm-hmm. What's happening, it seems to me, among other things, is that the sense of all of us being exactly alike or all of us being fundamentally alike is beginning to break down. And that relates to the concepts of the self and the investigations of the self that Pat was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Pat, Spax?
I think in relation to the question of plot really takes us back to the questions we started with about the relation to autobiography and particularly to spiritual autobiography. The assumption that most people in the 18th century would have without using the word plot would be that God creates the plots of human life, that human life has a plot, meaning it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has a purpose, it has a point, and all of those qualities are created for it by God. And it's in that sense that everybody is alike in having the beginning, middle, and end, but everybody is different in the way those things work out. Well, as the novel developed, it developed different concepts of what the end was, and the end of the early novel most often is marriage. But marriage can mean a lot of different things in the plot of a novel. In the plots of novels by Fielding, for example, books like Tom Jones and Joseph Andrews, or of early Smollett, books like Roderick Random, the young hero gets married at the end. The point of the marriage is that it's a declaration of independence. It's a sign of the fact that he has either freed himself from the constraints of his elders, or, well, that he has taken his place in society as an adult. By the time we get to Jane Austen, the marriage at the end of a novel means primarily a new affiliation, a new kind of unity and closeness. Mm-hmm. Those are totally different meanings for mm-hmm. the same mm-hmm. apparently the same plot structure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, at the risk of omitting the 19th century, Paul Hunter, Pat Spax, we're talking about the early English novel. Is it possible for you to generalize? Tell me why reading early English novels would help us to understand the novel today. For example, it's been pronounced dead many times and then revived. That's a sort of an old academic joke and conference topic. How might we better understand the literature that we move among now by looking at some of these early books? Are we going to look at them and think, my, how quaint or different or simplistic? Paul, Hunter?
Well, I don't think many 18th century novels read now as quaint or dated. Some of them do. Sometimes I think current readers, are puzzled by some aspects of language. The language has changed to some extent. Some 18th century novels are more formal mm-hmm. In the way they use language than 20th century examples. But there's been a real continuity in the novel from its beginning to the present time. As you say, people often talk about how the novel is dead or dying. It gets resurrected every time that happens, as far as I can see. It's been a very enduring form, and I think that while the issues change considerably from generation to generation, as well as from century to century, the elements, the things that that novels are about, the kinds of interests that they generate have stayed pretty similar from the beginning. I think there are good reasons to read 18th century novels besides historical reasons. They're still very much about what Fielding called the diet of human nature. People read novels, I think, because they want to know what other human beings are like. Mm-hmm. And human beings are different in different times. They're different in different cultures, even different from one county to another, perhaps. Some 18th century novels make a big point of that. But I think those are the reasons are enduring reasons, not because human nature doesn't change, but because we're all continue to be interested in the varieties of human nature and as many of those varieties as we can find.
Pat, let me put a question to you. Pat Spax from Yale University and Paul Hunter from the University of Rochester. We're talking about the early English novel. Tell me about the Gothic novel. These are still great fun. They're still being written today. For example, is there a direct lineage between the sorts of things that we see today and what went on in the 18th century? What were they like on their own terms? Pat?
I feel embarrassed to confess that I have not read any examples of the recent Gothic novel, although everything that I'm told about them suggests that there is a direct line of continuity. I'm extremely interested in the 18th century Gothic novel. The Gothic novel became a very important and popular form toward the very end of the 18th century, and many of the early Gothic novels were written by women, as indeed they still are. These Gothics by women always have heroines as opposed to heroes, and the heroines always undergo a very harrowing set of adventures out of which they finally triumph. And at one level, what is interesting about the Gothic is the opportunity that it gives for women in this fantasy world to have triumphs. But what is perhaps more interesting about it is the degree to which it offers a way for women to express in some disguise the kind of fears that they as women felt, and particularly fears of male power. In Anne Radcliffe's novels, which are particularly good, I think, there are a lot of supernatural appearances, and all the supernatural appearances are explained away in the long run. It turns out that there aren't really any ghosts. There are just illusions of ghosts. And this is a way of suggesting that a lot of the causes of terror may finally be illusory and created by the imagination, and that doesn't make them one whit less terrifying.
Well, now wait, are we blaming the victim here? Is that what I hear you say when we look at women in these novels who are creating illusions about their fears and they get explained away at the end of the book, and therefore we should conclude that, what, we have neurotic characters? How have I misunderstood you there?
Well, it's not certainly that they are neurotic characters. There is every reason for them to be afraid. Anybody in the situation would be afraid. The point is that the author has created this whole series of events in order to provide a way of talking about a kind of fear which is very real and justifiable fear, mm-hmm. and also saying that maybe there isn't as much to be afraid of as it seems.
There's a
this is Paul Hunter.
Wayne, there's a kind of continuity, I think, between what happens in a lot of so-called more mainstream novels and in Gothic novels too, that might best be gotten at through the central term that Pat was just using, fear. An awful lot of what the novel is about from the beginning has to do with fear of the unknown, fear of dark corners in one's own mind, fear mm-hmm. of the unknown aspect in friends, fear that there are plans afoot in life or in the universe that one can't control. An awful lot of what happens in novels of all kinds is that characters try to turn back the frontiers a little bit and discover what some of those unknowns really consist in. The novel does deal in fear. I think it may be worth pointing out that although there is a tradition from the beginning of the novel up to the present time, whether one uses present-day Gothic novels or other novels, of the fear of the unknown, that there's a kind of continuity to the novel tradition from the oral tradition that could be put in terms of fear as well. I think one of the reasons that moralists were so worried about novels and so concerned that they would turn the heads of young people in particular, men and women, but particularly women, as Pat said, was that they felt that they had won, in a way, in the campaign against oral literature, if we can put it that way. They had suppressed, they did a very good job in England of suppressing the oral tradition and getting rid of a lot of the old folk tales of giants and goblins and witches, which, of course, were stories of the unknown, too. As you know, psychoanalysts in particular, in recent times have had a field day with fairy tales. There are literally dozens of books now about the meaning of fairy tales and their importance for children. And generally speaking, psychologists have come down in our time as being very positive about the way fairy tales work to help children deal with fears. In the 18th century, they were not happy at all with the way those kinds of stories help people deal with fears. There's a wonderful anecdote about John Locke. It's an anecdote that I just came across a few months ago in some reading in the mid-18th century. It's a story that was told about John Locke, apparently on his own authority, that makes sense of some passages that that he wrote about his concerns with nurses and the kinds of tales that they told children when they were growing up. In the essay concerning human understanding and in some thoughts concerning education, both he launches into lengthy attacks on nurses' tales and urges parents not to allow their children to listen to the tales that their nursemaids will tell them. And the anecdote that I came across about him, which he apparently told about himself, was that he remembered so vividly some of the stories that his own nurses told him when he was growing up, that he was never, even in his adult life, able to overcome his fear of the dark. Now, if you think of this person who's really sort of the apostle of the Enlightenment, maybe almost the inventor of the Enlightenment as far as England is concerned, being afraid of the dark, you have a vivid image of a kind of fear of the narrative tradition or a fear of the oral tradition in the form that that took. People like Locke were so successful at repressing or suppressing oral tales of that sort that the oral tradition or parts of the oral tradition were virtually stamped out in England. And one irony, I think, is that the novel in some ways took its place, but you can certainly see as a result of that why they were so concerned that the novel wouldn't deal with some of the aspects that oral stories had dealt with and wouldn't deal with some aspects of the unknown, some supernatural elements or fears of supernatural elements that were unexplained.
Pat Spacks.
One of the themes of the early novel is the dangers of the imagination. Over and over again in these novels themselves, there will be characters concerned with the subject of stories that are being told, and characters concerned with the dangers of reading novels, presumably other novels. And there's a very famous passage in Northanger Abbey, which is the first of Jane Austen's novels to be finished, although the last to be published. She probably wrote it very late in the 18th century, in which the narrator of the novel says, "I am going to defend novels. I don't understand this tradition of novelists criticizing novels when novels, in fact, are the way that we know about human nature, the way we know about everything authentic in life." And that was something new for Jane Austen to say the novel is a good thing, not a dangerous thing.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about the origins and development of English fiction. My guests were Paul Hunter of the University of Rochester and Patricia Meyer Spacks of Yale University. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Early English Fiction, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about popular entertainment in America during the 19th century. My guest will be Robert Allen of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about early English fiction. Wayne's guests are scholars from the University of Rochester and Yale University. Early British fiction was very popular, but also had its critics. Samuel Johnson, for example, declared that readers of novels were the young, the ignorant, and the idle. Early English fiction. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.